Welcome to the MacArthur Memorial Podcast. Located in Norfolk, Virginia, the MacArthur Memorial is a museum and research center dedicated to the life and legacy of General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. The memorial is also dedicated to preserving and presenting the story of the millions of men and women who served with General MacArthur. Each month, the staff of the memorial will use this podcast to explore topics relating to General MacArthur and his times. The following lecture by Dr. Teresa Kaminsky, author of the book Angels of the Underground, The American Women Who Resisted the Japanese in the Philippines in World War II, took place at the MacArthur Memorial's World War II Symposium in July 2016.
Welcome back, everyone. So, we've been through MacArthur, been through New Guinea, and now we'll take it to the Philippines. And this one gets into a very confusing subject at times, and that's the Manila espionage rings that were going around, many of them not knowing who each other was. Our guest speaker is Dr. Teresa Kaminsky. You've seen that we had two different speakers before and their styles and what they do, and Dr. Kaminsky teaches up one of the satellites of University of Wisconsin, and so she, too, has a hard time getting around because of school. But we're so glad that she chose to come here, and again, it's that element that ties them all together, and that's the research at MacArthur Memorial. So without further ado, Dr. Teresa Kaminsky.
Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I wanted to thank Jim and everybody here at the MacArthur for this very kind invitation. I think from now on, though, I am going to use Jim's excuse, I'm working here, but for other things. This is an invitation I would never have passed up on, the chance to talk about these angels, and so I am very grateful for the invitation, and I am working right here today to do this and to deliver this presentation. I am a college professor. I am kind of used to PowerPoint. I'm not used to cameras. I'm used to audiences like this, but they're usually freshmen and sophomores. And so I hope you'll excuse any scholarly language that might sort of escape my lips, even though what I'm trying to do this afternoon really is to tell a story, and a story that has not been told very often about World War II and this particular aspect of life in the Pacific Theater. I know I'm in a different war here, but I think most of you recognize this image. This is from one of the opening scenes of Gone with the Wind. And we have Scarlett O'Hara talking with the Tarleton twins just as the Civil War is breaking out. And what really strikes me about this, Gone with the Wind was published in 1936. It was made into a movie in 1939, and I think you all know the basic story there. But in the course of the novel, Margaret Mitchell writes, "War is men's business." And then she spends about 800 pages showing us exactly what Scarlett O'Hara did to survive the war and to live through the years of the rebuilding. And what we do know about Scarlett O'Hara, she lied, she cheated, she stole, and in one very famous case, she committed murder to make sure that she got through the war. And I keep coming back to this image and Margaret Mitchell's comment because I think it very much reflects the fact that for women's roles in wartime, we as Americans have tried to believe that statement that war is men's business. But as Margaret Mitchell also proved, that's totally not true. Women have always, always been involved in war, even though they are not involved in the decision-making. They're not the politicians, they're not the military leaders, but they live on a daily basis with the consequences of those decisions. And so that's why I always think about Margaret Mitchell and Scarlett O'Hara as I start contemplating why it's important to know about the kinds of women that I wrote about in Angels of the Underground, because they are very complicated. They don't present us with a very black and white, cut and dried picture of the way that people are supposed to behave. what we are familiar with in terms of images of women during World War II, there were opportunities for American women to participate. And I think most of us have seen some of these images. We do know that this was the first time in American history where women were allowed into all of the branches of the armed services. Not that they were kept out during World War I, but during the Second World War, we have a much more complete form of service, the WACS, the WAVES, all of those branches allowing women into military service. Their positions, especially as medical personnel, nurses, were very much needed during the war. We also have seen lots of very familiar images of Rosie the Riveter, all of the 6 million women who went into factories. So there were a lot of different opportunities for women. But what also kind of stuck in the minds of Americans was that even if women could participate in these various ways during the war, the one thing that was supposed to distinguish American women from all other women during this conflict was that they would never be put into harm's way unless they chose to. If they were with one of the branches of the military, especially with one of the nursing corps, then they understood this was a choice that they made. But other than that, women were supposed to be safe. They were supposed to be non-combatants. And for the most part, for American women at least, that was true, except for the women who were living in the Philippines. My story focuses on what happened to those American women who were caught in that time period that many historians of Douglas MacArthur dispense with in a single sentence, right? MacArthur evacuated from Corregidor and he returned. And it makes you wonder, or it's made me wonder for a very long time, what happened? What happened to other people after MacArthur left, after the American and Filipino forces were forced to surrender to the Japanese? What was life like on those occupied islands? And just in case anybody needs a reminder, I think probably most of you don't, but the reason that Americans were there in the first place, numbering into the thousands, has to do with American imperialism. The expansionist nature of the American government in the early 20th century led to a takeover of the Philippines following the Spanish-American War. The United States remained there in the early 20th century, putting it on a direct path of confrontation with the Japanese, who were also very interested in territorial expansion and occupying the Philippines as well. So in 1941, with the attack at Pearl Harbor and the Philippine Islands, that contest came to a head. And there were lots of civilians then who were caught in the middle of that. And this is one of my favorite photos taken in, I think, early January 1942, shortly after the Japanese occupied the city of Manila. And when that happened, the four women that I feature in Angels of the Underground were all faced with a decision. One of these women is pictured here. We see her on the left there, Peggy Utinsky. She's standing actually with some in-laws of hers. That's not her own family. But Peggy Utinsky had gone to the Philippines probably in the late 1920s. She was trained as a nurse. She was a civilian nurse. She needed a vacation. She was widowed. She had a small son at the time. She thought it would be nice to visit the Philippines. We're not sure how she got there, but she did. She ended up in Manila. She loved it there. She didn't want to leave, and she didn't have to leave because she fell in love, and she got married. We see pictured on the right her husband, Jack Utinsky. This is when he was much younger and serving in World War I. And after that war, he settled in the Philippines. He was, at the time, working as a civilian engineer on the island of Corregidor. After he married Peggy, the two of them settled on Corregidor, and Peggy was envisioning this very happy future for them, a life of leisure, lots of time to play bridge and to go dancing and listen to music at night. Nobody really thought what was coming was actually going to happen. Another woman in Angels of the Underground, Gladys Savary, I don't have a good image of her. This is from the cover of her book, an illustration showing her cycling past the gates of Santo Tomas, where the other civilians were interned. Gladys Savary was an American woman from Nebraska. She liked to travel. Some of her travels in the 20s and 30s led her to various places in the world. She married a Frenchman named André Savary. Together they opened up what was considered one of the best French restaurants in the city of Manila. In 1939, her husband, as a French citizen, went off to join the French army and never returned to Manila. Gladys remained in the city operating her restaurant for as long as she possibly could. Third woman in Angels of the Underground. We see her pictured all the way on the far left with the big camera. Nobody needs cameras like those anymore. This is Yai Panlilio. She was born in the United States. Her mother was a Filipina immigrant. Her father was Irish American. She returned to the Philippines really still as a teenager with her first marriage, and she carved out a career as a journalist. While she was working in and around Manila, she also said she was recruited into U.S. Army intelligence. She kept a close eye on Japanese immigrants in the islands and was reporting back everything she learned to her handlers in the Army. The fourth woman is probably, if anybody knows about Occupied Manila and some of the underground espionage work there, they are probably more familiar with this American woman, Claire Phillips. Claire Phillips went to Manila sometime in the late 1930s. She wanted to be famous. She was a singer, she was an entertainer, and she couldn't get a career going in the States and thought she'd have a better chance where Americans were considered to be more of a novelty. So she did have quite a bit of a career in local nightclubs in Manila, including the Metropolitan Theater, which was a big venue for entertainment. She also had a very short marriage to a Filipino while she was there, thought she was divorced from him. That's another big story that's in my book. But in the meantime, in late 1941, Claire Phillips entered into a relationship with a young American soldier recently arrived in Manila. He was with the 31st Infantry. His name was John Phillips. He was known as Phil. I don't have a photograph of him. As far as I know, there are none that exist. So this is just an image of the 31st Infantry. Phil was with the Communications Division. So all four of these women were living in Manila when the war started. They all remembered very clearly waking up early morning, December 8th, on a Monday. They still thought at the very beginning of this that there was a chance that MacArthur and his men were going to be able to defeat the Japanese very quickly. None of these women felt particularly panicky at this point. They thought perhaps the worst that they would have to live through would be a blockade. And they figured it would be a struggle, but they could live with that. As we all heard, though, this morning, things didn't quite go that way. The Japanese made very significant inroads very quickly. By Christmas time of 1941, General MacArthur decided to designate Manila as an open city, letting the Japanese know that the city would not be defended. In this way, there were hopes to save the infrastructure of the city and to save the civilians living there. In the meantime, of course, MacArthur's forces were falling back from Manila, and they were all heading, well, most of them were heading into the Bataan Peninsula. This was a delaying action designed to, again, hope against hope that some reinforcements could come in. But again, we kind of know the end of that story, and I'll say a little bit more about that as well. When American and Filipino forces left Manila, this gave the Japanese the opportunity to launch their invasion. On January 2nd of 1942, the Japanese moved into the city, and within days, they began the process of registering and interning all Allied nationals. So pretty much overnight, women like Peggy Utinsky and Claire Phillips became designated as enemy nationals. And in Manila, in the surrounding areas, Santo Tomas University was designated as the internment site. And this is an aerial photograph we have showing how the different campus buildings were used for internment. We, I think, all tend to think of very modern university campuses and think, well, if a situation like this occurs, it probably wouldn't be a bad thing to be concentrated on a university campus. You've got all sorts of buildings. You've got all those nice dormitories. But Santo Tomas was pretty much a day university. So the one thing it lacked was the one thing that thousands of internees would need, places to sleep, places to cook large amounts of food. All of that was lacking. And the Japanese occupation authorities were not particularly interested in providing resources to help out the civilian internees who were left pretty much on their own devices. Four women in Angels of the Underground made the determination very early on they were not going to end up in an internment camp. They were four American women. They knew Americans were being rounded up and interned, and they decided simply that they were not going to go. While the city was being occupied by the Japanese, Gladys Savary, Yai Panlilio, and Peggy Utinsky remained in the city. Gladys was actually exempted from internment. The Japanese considered that an American woman's or any woman's legal identity was tied to that of her husband's. So by 1941, since Germany helped set up the Vichy government, France was considered to be a conquered country, and Germany was an ally of Japan, the Japanese occupation authorities allowed Gladys her freedom because of her marriage to a French national. She very much downplayed the fact that her husband had gone off to fight with the Free French. She didn't think that would go over so well with the Japanese, but they were willing to allow her to remain out of internment. Yai, of course, capitalized on her Filipino heritage, and she put it about that she was, in fact, very anti-American. She was willing to work with the Japanese, and they, in fact, recruited her to work at a radio station in Manila, an occupation she eagerly took up because she used her time on the air to try and send coded messages down to Bataan and Corregidor while she was able to operate in the city. Peggy Utinsky hid out in her Manila apartment for 10 weeks, just hoping to evade anybody who could identify her as an American, and she figured that she would just decide what to do at some point in the near future. While Gladys remained out of internment, she used her restaurant connections to start supplying the civilian internees in Santo Tomas. She was friends with most of those people. She didn't like to see the situation they were in. She also started to branch out her supply network because her nephew was one of the American POWs after the fall of Bataan, and she wanted to make sure that military prisoners received some additional assistance as well. As I mentioned, Yai stayed in Manila for a couple of months until the situation became too dangerous for her. The Japanese figured out what she was doing while she was on the air, and they actually issued an arrest warrant for her. She got word of it just a few hours before it was supposed to be served. She was working her shift at the radio station. She skipped out and actually skipped out of the city just ahead of that arrest warrant. And her goal was always to find a way to get to the military to help. When she slipped out of Manila, she headed to the east into the mountains, and she figured she could find a guerrilla group there. And she did indeed run into Markings guerrillas, probably one of the largest and most well-known of the guerrilla forces on the island of Luzon. We see Yai, this is a post-war photograph taken with Marking. They were lovers as well as compatriots, and she did indeed spend the duration of the war in the hills with Marking, pretty much acting as his right-hand person and running his training camp while he was out in the field. Claire Phillips, with her relationship with John Phillips, he was part of the 31st Infantry, which retreated from Manila. He had her pack her things and follow along with U.S. forces into the Bataan Peninsula. They both believed that she would be safer the closer she stayed to the American Army. She also had a small daughter, a child she had with her first husband. So while the first battle for Bataan was going on, Claire Phillips was down in that peninsula trying to keep track of her fiancé and trying to keep herself and her daughter alive. The Bataan Peninsula also figures into Peggy Utinsky's story. After spending 10 weeks hiding out in her apartment, figuring out what she wanted to do, she also decided she needed to make her way to Bataan. When she emerged from her apartment during the spring of 1942, she had heard about the surrender. She knew that all of the other Americans were now in Santo Tomas, and she arranged to have false identity papers made. She paid for this. She understood it was a danger, but she capitalized on her married last name, Utinsky. She knew that Lithuania had been occupied by German forces. It was neutralized, so she figured she was safe in claiming Lithuanian citizenship. And with papers showing her as a Lithuanian citizen, she got a job with the newly constituted Philippine Red Cross, which got permission from the Japanese occupation authorities to go into the Bataan Peninsula once the battle was finished there and to help with civilian relief. And so Peggy made her way there shortly after the surrender, shortly after the death march, and all around her she saw the physical evidence of that battle and of that death march. And everywhere she set up a clinic and worked to nurse the civilians, she was asking anybody if they had seen her husband. She made a couple of trips with the Philippine Red Cross. This made the necessary connections that she would need for her own prisoner relief organization that she started very soon afterward. Claire stayed on Bataan. She also got separated from Phil. She couldn't find him. She went out looking for him several times, and one of the times when she thought she had found him, she in fact ran into another young soldier recently separated from the 31st Infantry. We see him pictured there on the left. His name was John Boone. John Boone's papers are in the archives here. Boone was getting ready to start up his own guerrilla force on Luzon. He asked Claire if she would help him out, and she put him off for a little while. She said she wasn't sure what she wanted to do, but Boone impressed upon her that guerrillas fighting in the hills all over Luzon could really use a lot of help from the city of Manila to help organize the dispersal of both information and supplies. When Claire learned the details of the death march, when she heard about the surrender of Corregidor, This is when Claire decided that she would, in fact, go back to Manila and figure out a way that she could help the defeated Americans and Filipinos. And she did pretty much the same thing that Peggy Utinsky did. When Claire returned to Manila, she had false identity papers made up that claimed she was an Italian national, again, Italy being the other ally there of Japan during the Second World War. She used the name Dorothy Fuentes. Fuentes was actually the name of her first Filipino husband. So she, by having these identity papers made up, she claimed exemption from internment as an Italian national and by virtue of her marriage to a Filipino citizen. And she also then decided to put her particular talents to use. She was a singer. She was an entertainer. And she figured that that would help get the kind of information that the guerrillas were going to need. In the meantime, Peggy Utinsky was trying to figure out how to get supplies into the prisoner of war camps. Her connections with the Red Cross led her to working also through the religious communities in Manila. In her neighborhood, there was a church, the Malati Church and Convent, which was staffed by a group of Irish priests. And Peggy drew on their help and support. This convent that was turned into a hospital during the war actually served as a huge warehouse for supplies that were collected for both the guerrillas and the POWs. They would be funneled into this convent, and the priests would help Peggy to disperse this aid. And for those of you who know about the death march, we know about the terrible loss of life during the process of that march. The prisoners ended up first at Camp O'Donnell and then at Cabanatuan. If the civilian internees at Santo Tomas had a hard time during the war, the military prisoners, of course, had it much worse. The Japanese and their attitudes about people who surrendered made the situation even more horrifying. And Peggy was getting all of this information very quickly about how many men were dying there each day from starvation and disease. And she worried very much that her husband Jack was one of those. She knew he had actually survived the surrender at Bataan. She knew he had made it into O'Donnell. She didn't know what had happened to him after that. So for both Claire and Peggy especially, their desire to help POWs, to help the guerrillas, was connected to personal issues. They had men in their lives who were involved with the military, and so they did feel it was their duty to help. While Peggy used medical and religious connections, Blair decided to open up a nightclub. With her faked identity papers, she worked with a local Chinese businessman to provide some backing for the Subaki Club. This is a photograph that was taken in 1945, just after the battle for Manila concluded, and we do see what most people believe are the remnants of the Club Subaki. The woman standing in front of it is not Claire Phillips. It's just some random whack who was walking around in Manila and had her picture taken in front of this this bombed-out structure. But in the fall of 1942, Claire Phillips opened up this nightclub, which was designed to cater specifically to high-ranking Japanese officials, both military and civilian. And while she and her staff were plying them with drinks and entertainment, they made sure that they were carefully listening to all of the conversations that were going on and gathering all of that information and reporting it back through John Boone's guerrilla forces. And Claire always believed that all of these messages did some way get to MacArthur's headquarters in Australia. So she was convinced while the war was going on that she was making a material contribution, especially through the intelligence that she was able to funnel. All of these activities, of course, were not welcome by the occupation authorities. Smuggling, spying, all of these were offenses that the Japanese Kempeitai kept a very close watch on. Lots of civilians were rounded up, arrested, and taken to Fort Santiago for interrogation. And Peggy and Claire both knew that they were living on borrowed time. They knew what happened to people who were caught, and they did know that the Japanese had a knack for eventually tracking down all of these people who were involved in these networks and trying to get them to talk, and if they didn't, then at least removing them from the situation. These women did live in fear of being arrested and taken to Fort Santiago. They did their work in spite of this fear and in spite of the fact that both of them were eventually arrested. The Japanese came for Peggy Utinsky first. They arrested her in a hospital in Manila where she was working. Ironically, her patient at the time of her arrest was none other than Claire Phillips. It's an interesting story. Peggy was taken to Fort Santiago. The Japanese suspected that she was really an American. And they didn't quite have a sense of her as the head of what was known as the Miss U Network, but they believed she was operating under a false nationality. She was interrogated for about 30 days in Fort Santiago, interrogation being a very benign term for torture. She refused to tell them anything. Without a confession, they actually let her go. She was released, and she laid very low in Manila after that, for obvious reasons. She was certain that the Japanese were going to figure out a way to pick her up. So in the meantime, the Miss U Network did continue to operate. Peggy kept a very low profile. The rest of her operatives basically picked up the slack. Claire Phillips, also known as High Pockets, was part of that Miss U Network. The Miss U Network was also made up of dozens, maybe hundreds, of Filipinos living in and around Manila. This was a vast enterprise that reached all the way to Cabanatuan. And this was a very long pipeline of prisoner aid. And in the spring of 1944, the Japanese finally unraveled that system. And they traced how these extra supplies were getting into the prisoners, these caribou carts that were used to bring supplies into the POW camp. Claire and Peggy had found out ways to pack them with extra supplies. And in the spring of 1944, the Japanese figured all of this out. They started arresting some of the prisoners in the camp. They started arresting operatives who were living around the camp of Cabanatuan. And finally, Claire Phillips and some of her supporters back in Manila in May of 1944 were also arrested. Claire spent some time in Fort Santiago as well, being interrogated. She was not let go. She was actually put on trial. She was convicted of helping to aid the prisoners, and she was sentenced to 10 years at hard labor in a women's prison. When Peggy Utinsky heard about Claire Phillips's arrest, she went to some friends who were hiding Claire's daughter, and Peggy took that little girl, Diane, and she went off to some guerrillas in the hills. And for the duration of the war, Peggy was a nurse with the guerrilla forces on Luzon. She was designated a brevet lieutenant. She had a rank. She carried a sidearm, although during the course of the months up in the hills, she had to increasingly use a smaller weapon because after a while she lost so much weight that she couldn't carry around a big gun. It just dragged on her, and she couldn't hold it up. But she did achieve that rank. She did achieve that distinction among the guerrillas, and she was in the hills when news came that the Americans had returned. So So now we've kind of bookended MacArthur's story. He has come back. So when the Americans came back to Luzon, where were our four women? Peggy Utinski in the hills with the guerrillas. Yai Panlilio to the east in the hills with Marking and his men. Gladys Savary living still unencumbered by internment, but living in one of the Manila neighborhoods, so she would actually experience that battle for Manila. And who are we missing? Claire, in prison. She's in jail, and she hears about the Americans arriving. The guerrillas make contact with her and let her know that they know that she's there. They're willing to spring her before the American troops get in. She says she'll wait and she'll hold on for that liberation. But in her final days, she was also worried because increasingly there were stories that the Japanese were simply killing all of their prisoners. You all know about the great raid at Cabanatuan, why that was carried out. Claire lived her last days in prison before liberation, wondering if the Japanese were in fact going to kill all the prisoners before the Americans got to them. But this was not the case. All four of these angels did in fact survive the war. I'm not really giving anything away from the end of the book. So in case you like that kind of suspense, that's not really what the suspense is. It's more how they survived. And in the end, then, what did liberation mean? What did it mean to have survived this war? All four of these women had nothing left at the end of the war. The men in their lives, with the exception of Yai, Marking did survive the war, but the other three women lost the men in their lives. Claire Phillips was reunited with her daughter. Peggy Utinski kept Diane safe during the war, brought her back, reunited her with her mother. And three of these four women were also awarded the Medal of Freedom after World War II. This was a medal that had been inaugurated specifically as a way of honoring civilians who had helped with the American cause outside of the United States. We see here Claire Phillips receiving her Medal of Freedom award. So there was some public recognition for what these women had done during the war. All four of these women wrote memoirs. You probably haven't heard of them. Probably the most best-selling was Yai's. As a professional journalist, she did get a big New York publishing house to take it. It did get some good reviews. Claire Phillips had her book published by a very small press in Oregon, and she's the only one of these four women who had the distinction and perhaps the honor of having Hollywood come knocking. There is actually a film version from 1951, I Was an American Spy, a classic, classic B movie. If you've never seen it, you really should. And it's not a terribly truthful rendition, though, of her experiences. And closing there, just for those of you who know period music, the only other thing that's well known from that B movie, this was a big hit in 1951-52 for Tony Bennett. This is really where he gets his start. The song Because of You was the theme song to the Claire Phillips story. And it's just kind of an interesting popular culture tie-in. But these women then did, I think they all experienced post-traumatic stress. They had no way of coping with it except writing their memoirs. And when they each died, there were no military honors for them. There were no even public recognitions of what they had done during the war. They simply faded away. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact Amanda Williams at amanda.williams@norfolk.gov.